time for reformers to play catch-up with new thinking, and yes, new rules about how much influence we allow philanthropists to have over our shared destinies. In many ways, the tension between philanthropic freedom and civic equality is a familiar one. Similar tug-of-wars have played out through U.S. history. America has struggled mightily with how to balance economic freedom with greater equity, as well as with other goals, like environmental and consumer protection. We've also struggled with how to balance personal freedom and civil liberties with concerns for social order, national security, and the common good. If we can navigate those challenges, as we have in the past, we should be able to figure out a way to impose reasonable limits on philanthropic freedom so that it doesn't bulldoze the egalitarian ideals we hold dear, ideals, by the way, that impress Tocqueville far more than America's robust nonprofit sector. The key here is striking the right balance, and regulating economic freedom offers a helpful parallel. Ideally, efforts to soften the harsh edges of capitalism don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg of dynamic wealth creation. In the case of curbing philanthropic freedom, we should be thinking about nips and tucks that don't undermine the overall vibrancy of civil society. We want to target the philanthropic behavior that's most troubling, not hobble the sector as a whole. And, mindful of the dangers of the state meddling in civil society, we want to find ways to insulate the mechanisms of philanthropic oversight from the political pressures of the moment. None of that sounds so impossible, since we've done it all before in regulating other sectors of U.S. society. Ideas for reform. What kinds of changes might bring more democratic oversight to philanthropy? Plenty of experts have weighed in on that question over many decades, offering up various ideas for reform, most of which have gone nowhere. I can't pretend to have found any new silver bullets in my own explorations, but I will say this. The stakes are rising as private donors become more powerful in American society, and, at the same time, existing oversight becomes less able to keep up and to protect the public interest. What follows are a few suggestions for updating and strengthening the rules that govern philanthropy. More transparency. When wealthy people and foundation staff use philanthropy to shape our society's direction, and especially public policy, their fellow citizens should know what they're up to. Yet often, that is not the case. There is no legal requirement by funders to reveal where they are making grants, nor do most nonprofits have to reveal their donors. Private foundations have to report their grants in annual tax returns, but it can be several years before those returns are available to the public. Some established foundations do a great job of being transparent. Most do not. Data available through the Foundation Center on the top 80 or so U.S. foundations reveals that just 26 of them share timely information about their grant-making through online grant databases. These include some of the biggest players in philanthropy. The Susan Thompson Buffett Foundation, one of the top 5 grant-makers in the United States, is a case study in non-transparency. This leading funder of reproductive health work, including abortion services around the United States, has no real website, and the information available on its grant-making through tax returns is always a few years out of date. But if you really want to peer into a black hole, take a look at donor-advised funds, which reveal where grants go on annual tax returns, but not who gave that money. In 2015, more than $13 billion in grants moved through donor-advised funds. Among these entities are some of the largest grant-makers in the United States, like Fidelity Charitable, as well as leading funders of ideological policy groups, such as Tides and Donors Trust. As more new donors turn to DAFs instead of traditional foundations, philanthropy is becoming less transparent. Other kinds of giving vehicles can also hide the tracks of funders. When Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan announced they would give away nearly all of their Facebook stock, they also unveiled a new limited liability company, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, which directs their giving and isn't subject to the same disclosure rules as nonprofits and foundations. Laureen Powell Jobs also does her philanthropy through an LLC, the Emerson Collective, making it hard to know what causes one of America's richest women is getting behind. Some megadonors have used anonymous private foundations, funded and controlled by LLCs, to do their giving. Among them has been David Gelbaum, who, along with two other hedge fund colleagues, used a complex network of secretive entities to give away hundreds of millions of dollars. Some of his biggest gifts went to the ACLU and Sierra Club, groups actively seeking to sway public policy. Another donor in this trio, Andrew Schechtel, was revealed in 2014 to control two anonymous charitable trusts that hold $9.7 billion in assets. These are all examples of how yesterday's nonprofit disclosure rules are being rendered moot by changes in the sector amid an explosion of new giving. Why is transparency, along with the timely reporting of grants, such a big deal? Because without it, citizens don't know who's shaping decisions that affect their lives or what their motives might be. The Iran nuclear debate is a perfect example. Millions in philanthropic and political gifts sought to influence one of the most important national security debates of recent years. Yet it was hard to get any real-time information on who was writing the checks. We'll probably never get a full picture of the funders involved, given how easy it is to keep donations anonymous forever. A similar veil of secrecy shrouds other important recent debates. We'll likely never know, for example, the full extent of philanthropic giving to help enact and implement the Affordable Care Act, or to try to block and weaken that law, which was among the most consequential policy changes in a generation. There's plenty of hard-to-trace philanthropy happening locally, too, around crucial public debates. In early 2015, for example, a school reform group in Philadelphia offered $35 million to help that city close a funding gap, but it demanded the right to open more charters as a condition, all without disclosing who was putting up this money. Also that year, a new nonprofit in New York began a legal push to weaken tenure laws for teachers in the state. It refused to disclose its donors. As mentioned earlier, funds from the Walton Family Foundation make up a big chunk of the revenues of the Black Alliance for Educational Options. Who are the alliance's other top donors? That information isn't public, and the same is true of numerous other advocacy groups on both the left and the right. Dark philanthropic money has also become a more potent tool for partisan political gains, financing efforts to mobilize or suppress targeted groups of voters, as well as to investigate and attack politicians. But while there is a big push to bring more sunlight to campaign money in the wake of the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Citizens United, there have been few calls to crack down on secretive charitable giving or to require more timely reporting of gifts. That doesn't make much sense. Among other things, if campaign finance reformers ever do succeed, philanthropy will likely become an even more popular means by which the wealthy pursue policy change. Today's shadow giving system is strongly defended by champions of philanthropic freedom, who say a right to privacy in giving is a key part of such freedom. And certainly donors can have some good reasons for anonymity. Maybe you don't want to be hit up by other fundraisers, or you believe donors should be humble, or maybe you're worried about serious retaliation, as was the case with donors to the NAACP in the Deep South during the 1950s, and is sometimes the case today, such as for donors giving to restrict LGBT rights. These privacy concerns are understandable, but ultimately should not trump the public's interest in greater transparency at a time when a wealthy minority exerts growing influence over public policy and people's lives. This is an area where the value of philanthropic freedom can't be absolute. Donor-advised funds should be required to disclose their donors just as private foundations must, and most nonprofits engaged in policy or advocacy work should also have to reveal their donors. Transparency should be the default expectation. Limiting politicized philanthropy. If I donate to a politician who I believe will help enact certain public policies, I don't get to deduct the gift on my tax return. That's how it should be. My fellow taxpayers shouldn't help foot the bill of promoting my political beliefs. On the other hand, if I donate to a think tank or advocacy group for the exact same reason, to influence public policy, I can deduct the gift on my tax return. That may not sound like it makes much sense, but it reflects current law. A century ago, the War Revenue Act of 1917 provided a tax deduction for gifts made to corporations or associations organized and operated exclusively for religious, charitable, scientific, or educational purposes, or to societies for the prevention of cruelty to children or animals. This is one of the oldest breaks in the tax code, and while it's evolved in various respects, the basic idea hasn't changed much. The IRS broadly defines what activities tax-exempt 501c3s can engage in that are deemed charitable, a wide menu that includes relief of the poor, the distressed, or the underprivileged, as well as defending human and civil rights and lessening the burdens of government. This definition is broad enough that the IRS makes no distinction between what most of us would think of as charity, say, donating to a food bank, and activities that are more political, like donating to an effort to abolish food stamps. I would get the same tax break for contributing to an emergency fund to help unemployed coal miners as I would for contributing to a push to shut down coal-fired energy plants. I'd get the same deduction for giving to a local health clinic as I would for donating to a policy group that wants to strip that clinic of funding. Today's vast world of nonprofit groups with strong policy agendas didn't exist a century ago. This world didn't even exist a half century ago, when Congress last revisited charitable tax law in a major way. It has emerged largely since the 1970s, financed by a new breed of activist philanthropists like Richard Scaife on the right and George Soros on the left. The past decade has seen a notable acceleration in money flowing to this world. Yet charitable tax law has remained largely unchanged. Nobody knows for sure the scope of tax-subsidized giving that flows every year to 501c3 nonprofit organizations that expressly aim to shift public policies that affect the lives of Americans. It's hard to tally up all contributions made to thousands of policy and advocacy groups at both the national and the state levels, given the limitations in data on where charitable donations go. As well, not everyone who donates to such groups takes advantage of the charitable deduction. Typically, only affluent people itemize deductions on their tax returns, which is the only way to make use of the exemption. What might be a ballpark estimate of the total tax-deductible charitable contributions made to policy and advocacy groups every year? We're probably talking about a sum in the low billions, less than $10 billion. That number doesn't sound huge, but it's much more than the combined annual political giving to candidates, party committees, 501c4s, and super PACs. Just the top five environmental groups in the United States pulled in more than $500 million in 2015 in charitable contributions. The right's biggest think tank, the Heritage Foundation, pulled in a record $129 million in contributions that same year. Most policy groups raise much less than these organizations, but there are huge numbers of them. As we've seen, nearly every state now has smaller versions of the ideological think tanks that have become so influential in Washington. Some policy and advocacy groups raise significant funds from minor donors, but the bulk of such money tends to come from the wealthy and foundations. For example, the American Enterprise Institute, which raised $55 million in 2015, has fewer than 1,500 donors, who contribute, on average, $35,000 each to have their values expressed in national policy debates, as Arthur Brooks described it. That's more money than most U.S. workers earn in a year. Whatever the exact numbers, the bottom line is that all taxpayers are subsidizing the efforts of the wealthy to influence public policy. It's not just that the megaphones operated by 501c3 groups and financed by a sliver of rich donors have gotten louder and louder, making it harder for ordinary citizens to be heard. It's that these citizens are helping foot the bill for those megaphones. The charitable tax deduction has long enjoyed strong support because there's an assumption that those donations help better society. Most of us don't mind paying a little bit extra in taxes every year to make up for the money lost to the deduction, which was around $47 billion in 2016. But most of us probably would mind helping foot the bill for gifts to the Republican or Democratic parties. There are big, obvious differences between political parties and nonprofits like Heritage or CAP. What they share in common is the goal of making changes to public policy. In fact, policy groups and political parties often work in close concert with each other, as we've seen. Given the politicization of nonprofits over the past half century, it's time to rethink which groups really should qualify for tax-exempt status. One obvious solution here is to redraw the line that now separates 501c3 nonprofits from their cousins, the 501c4s, donations to which are not tax-deductible. Such nonprofits have famously become political powerhouses. The NRA, the AARP, and the NAACP are all 501c4s, although there are also many that have nothing to do with public policy. The IRS defines them as civic leagues or organizations not organized for profit but operated exclusively for the promotion of social welfare. The reason tax-exempt dollars can't flow to 501c4s is that many often engage in what the IRS refers to as non-deductible lobbying and political expenditures, with goals that include influencing legislation or trying to influence the general public with respect to elections, legislative matters, or referendums. Today, plenty of 501c3s that can receive tax-exempt donations are pursuing the same goals, only a few steps further upstream. Such groups do things like write reports that argue for or against a higher minimum wage, whereas 501c4s publish reports that argue for or against passage of legislation or ballot initiatives that actually would raise the minimum wage. The differences are often meaningless, a fact that the donor class well understands. Indeed, the most savvy donors know they can often have the greatest influence by funding upstream, shaping what ideas get on the legislative agenda in the first place. The time has come for the IRS to define more narrowly what constitutes charitable activities by 501c3 groups, with the result that many of these policy and advocacy organizations would be reclassified as 501c4s, and contributions to them would no longer be tax deductible. To be sure, this would be quite disruptive to such groups, and likely fatal to quite a few. Foundations that now fund lots of policy and advocacy work would have to shift away from it, leaving big gaps in nonprofit budgets. Still, it's hard to argue that this step would infringe on anyone's freedom. Wealthy donors could still give all the money they want to places like Heritage or CAP. The important thing is that we'd end the charade that such gifts are charity, and thus that taxpayers should help foot the bill. Greater accountability. One of the great strengths of philanthropy is that donors and foundations are only minimally accountable to any outside authority or constituency. It allows funders to take risks without worrying about losing their jobs, unlike politicians or the CEOs of public corporations. This part of philanthropic freedom is mostly a good thing, and we don't want to mess with it by imposing too much new oversight. What I think the public can and should demand, though, is to know what society is getting in return for billions in charitable tax breaks. The U.S. Treasury has estimated that the cost of such breaks over the next decade will total around $740 billion. That's serious money in an age of fiscal austerity when we're kicking people off food stamps, cutting science funding, yanking away housing vouchers from the poor, and so on. But despite frequent discussion of the charitable deduction, it's hard to say whether the cost of these breaks is worth it, in terms of the public benefits, compared to other priorities. Nor, for a growing share of tax-exempt gifts, do we know when such benefits will start to flow, since donor-advised funds have no annual payout requirement, unlike foundations. While donors get an immediate tax deduction for contributing to DAFs, they have no near-term obligation to make gifts out of such funds. The easiest reform to enact here is to compel donor-advised funds to distribute money at the same rates as foundations. Even though DAFs already do a good job on such payout, today's lax rules create too great a risk that, over time, piles of untaxed wealth will grow ever higher without society seeing commensurate returns. The same can be said, by the way, about foundation endowments, which will grow much larger at the same time that government coffers grow emptier. That's unlikely to sit well over time with the public, and there's a strong case for increasing the required foundation payout rate beyond 5%. The thornier question is what the public is getting in return for tax breaks granted for philanthropy, which mainly go to the wealthy. The way the tax code helps amplify upper-class power seems problematic on its face, unless we can easily agree that the benefits are overwhelmingly positive and fairly distributed. Right now, though, no independent authority, like, for instance, the Congressional Budget Office or the Government Accountability Office, works to analyze how these benefits play out. To take one example, John Paulson's $400 million gift to Harvard in 2015 will cost the Treasury tens of millions of dollars at a time that Pell Grants for needy college students are being cut. Is that okay? Maybe, or maybe not, depending upon the projected public benefits of that subsidy to America's richest university. Perhaps the cost of Paulson's gift is actually a bargain for taxpayers because the applied science research he is supporting will produce major economic gains for society. We don't have a clue, one way or another, since no effort is being made to analyze the benefits of charitable tax breaks. What's more, some people are wary of even asking the question, since that could lead down the slippery slope of government making choices about what forms of charity are worth subsidizing, which would infringe on philanthropic freedom. I agree that, beyond limiting tax breaks for politicized giving, government shouldn't take a heavy-handed approach to deciding which nonprofits should be able to accept tax-exempt gifts. Who's to say whether funding for the arts, for example, is valuable to society? On the other hand, plenty of people are already arguing that Congress should limit the charitable exemption because it doesn't deliver enough value to society. Some say that in an era of dire fiscal choices, we could put that lost revenue to better use. It's hard to know how to evaluate such claims without more information on the benefits of tax-exempt charitable giving. Who's getting what here? Broadly speaking, while we know it's largely the wealthy who make use of the charitable tax deduction, we don't know which communities or groups benefit from those gifts and how. We are able to answer these crucial questions in regard to other huge tax breaks, like for mortgage interest and healthcare costs, but we're flying blind on the charitable tax deduction. What's more, we're flying blind into the biggest giving spree in history, with a slew of billionaires likely to die in the next few decades. The total of tax revenues lost due to charitable gifts will become ever more eye-popping, even as every tax break comes under closer scrutiny as the fiscal screws tighten in Washington. It doesn't help matters that we also can't answer basic questions about the efficiency of the charitable sector. Take the matter of foundations' administrative costs. How much such spending is too much? Right now, we don't have a clue. The Ford Foundation's overhead costs in the past decade have been running at over 20% of its annual spending and have totaled over $1 billion in the past decade. Many other top foundations have similar costs, with staff at the top 10 foundations paid some $600 million annually. Maybe that money is well spent, because all those smart program officers work to leverage foundation dollars and achieve more impact. Or maybe it's an outrageous waste, since plenty of foundations achieve comparable impact with much lower overhead costs. Your guess is as good as mine, since no one actually knows which foundations get the most bang for their buck. This means there's no real way to shame spendthrift funders that live high on the hog with tax-subsidized money while delivering poor performance, or to praise models of efficiency that should be replicated. The philanthropic sector has simply never devoted enough resources to evaluating its own performance in a rigorous way. The work that now goes on to evaluate foundations by the Center for Effective Philanthropy, the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy, and other groups is excellent, but limited in scope. Also, all these organizations are dependent on foundation funding, which may crimp their watchdog role. Meanwhile, no government agency is on the case either. Should we be worried about the lack of independent oversight in regard to the efficiency of foundations and philanthropy writ large? A purist on philanthropic freedom would likely say no, that it's the funders' own money and how well they spend it is no one else's business. Others might say that many questions are basically unanswerable, and the last thing we need is to flood the social sector with more bean counters. Ultimately, though, it's not okay to settle for a status quo in which the foundation world remains forever a black box, filled with an expanding array of wealthy tax-exempt institutions that are of uncertain effectiveness and ever more costly to the U.S. Treasury. The public has a right to know more about the efficiency of this sector. It's even less okay that the government watchdogs that are supposed to enforce charitable laws are notoriously feeble. The United States has some 1.5 million tax-exempt nonprofits, and just over a million of them are eligible to receive deductible contributions. Policing these myriad groups, which together hold $2.7 trillion in assets, is a big job, and one that neither federal or state agencies are equipped to handle. That's true of the IRS, which saw cuts to its nonprofit division during the early Obama years. It had less than 900 employees in 2012 to ensure compliance with tax law across a vast nonprofit sector that's been growing ever more politicized and complex. The job of reviewing some 60,000 nonprofit applications every year fell to just 200 low-level employees at a regional IRS office in Cincinnati. After accusations that the agency had unfairly scrutinized Tea Party groups seeking tax-exempt status, Congress responded by curtailing the IRS's oversight powers and making it easier for groups to get nonprofit status. Exactly the wrong response. As for keeping an eye on foundations, one expert estimated in 2016 that the IRS scrutinizes less than 1% of all 990 tax forms these nonprofits file every year. This lax oversight is an invitation to abuse. Things aren't much better at the state level. A recent study found that even as the number of nonprofits has grown in recent years, the enforcement capacity of the public watchdogs overseeing nonprofits, most notably offices of state attorneys general, has largely remained flat. This weak oversight helps explain a steady stream of charity fraud cases, including one involving a bogus anti-cancer group that raised nearly $200 million. State officials cracked down on that scam, but who knows what other abuses have gone undetected, or what new scandals may emerge down the line. Stronger watchdogs are a must if the charitable sector wants to ensure the trust of the American public. Likewise, if the wealthy are going to get ongoing public subsidies to set up yet more foundations and donor-advised funds, and even bigger ones, it's reasonable to ask for more evidence that all of society is benefiting from this setup. Stronger accountability for philanthropy, through expanded regulatory oversight and new research on the benefits and efficiency of charitable giving, won't come cheap. Who should foot the bill? And how should such an effort be organized? The first question is easy to answer. Private foundations already pay a 2% federal excise tax on their annual investment income that generates more than $500 million a year in revenue. The tax is supposed to cover the costs of IRS oversight of charities, but it stopped being earmarked for this purpose in the 1990s, and it's fair to say that the nonprofit sector isn't getting its money's worth. Far more should be done with the excise tax income. Beefing up the IRS enforcement capacity is an obvious need, and it would also make sense to grant out some of these funds to the states, given their frontline role in policing charities. More intriguing is the idea of devoting a portion of excise tax revenue to research philanthropy and nonprofits, analyzing the benefits of charitable giving as well as the sector's performance. Such an effort could be orchestrated by a new U.S. Federal Office of Charitable Affairs, which could contract out much of the work to nonprofits and universities. Just as the federal government has spent many millions assessing various social programs, relying on groups like the Urban Institute and Manpower Demonstration Corporation, it makes sense to devote public resources to studying how well philanthropic dollars are spent, since every taxpayer has an interest in answering these questions too. A new Office of Charitable Affairs could also help orchestrate partnerships between government and philanthropy, work that's been growing in recent years. In addition, it could provide help to people seeking to start nonprofits and foundations, or running them, just as other agencies like the Small Business Administration and U.S. Department of Agriculture offer a wealth of how-to information and services. With the nonprofit sector accounting for over 5% of GDP, and 10% of the private sector employment, it makes sense for government to get more organized about supporting it. A new U.S. Office of Charitable Affairs could also assist with some of the compliance challenges that have overwhelmed the IRS in recent years. These issues can be complex and nuanced, requiring an expertise on nonprofits unlikely to be nurtured at the IRS. One last point. To insulate a new charitable affairs agency from political pressures, its governance might resemble that of the Federal Reserve or other independent agencies whose leaders serve extended terms to reduce their dependence on partisan patrons. Getting ahead of the curve. Many leaders in philanthropy and the nonprofit sector have zero interest in the kinds of reforms I'm proposing, however modest they may be. They fear government meddling in a hugely successful American experiment that has thrived with few outside constraints. I understand those fears. We don't want to mess up a good thing. But there's a larger principle involved here. In a democracy, all powerful institutions that affect our lives need vigilant oversight. Philanthropy is no exception. Right now, it's one of the last major sectors of U.S. society that gets to basically do as it pleases, answering to no one. That can't last. We live in an age of skepticism, remember, and public trust in all institutions has fallen in recent decades. The charitable sector is doing better than most others, but it hasn't been immune from the overall trend. Judging by some of what we've seen in recent years, the backlash to Mark Zuckerberg's outsized philanthropy, the intense criticism of charter school funders, the allegations about the Clinton and Trump foundations, more Americans are getting nervous about how the wealthy are using philanthropy as a tool of influence in an age of inequality. Those fears have risen, even though most people are in fact clueless about just how much influence philanthropy really does wield in U.S. society. As I've shown in this book, the power of the givers is much greater than many people realize. Public concern is likely to grow as private giving gets bigger in coming years. This is one reason why, instead of fighting more oversight, leaders in philanthropy should embrace it. They shouldn't make the same mistake their peers in other sectors have made, insisting that yesterday's level of oversight is still fine even though conditions have dramatically changed. Think of how that kind of denial has played out in recent years for higher education, the National Football League, or the accounting and mortgage industries. And yes, things really have changed in philanthropy in just the past decade or two. We're seeing a historic influx of new wealth that is bringing more activist living donors into the sector, and at times, they throw their weight around in troubling ways. We're seeing the rise of powerful giving networks like the Democracy Alliance and the one organized by the Koch brothers. We're seeing the growing popularity of donor-advised funds that are part of a shadow giving system that has made philanthropy less transparent in recent years. The backdrop for all these shifts is the decline in the resources and problem-solving capacities of government. Power seems to be shifting away from elected public officials, who face growing fiscal constraints, to unelected private funders with ever deeper pockets. This is happening at a time of growing public unease about the wealthy and elites generally. These are big changes, and philanthropy's leaders need to accept that now new oversight is needed to catch up. Otherwise, they risk ceding the initiative to outside reformers. That's a movie we've seen before, a bunch of times. An insular sector defends a badly dated oversight regime, even as conditions change and new problems emerge, along with new public concerns. It reflexively fights every reform that comes along, however modest. The sector thinks it's different and special, and that its free pass is good forever. Then, because of some scandal or investigation or citizens' movement or shift in culture, everything changes, and the result is a massive loss of public trust and more heavy-handed government regulation than might otherwise have been the case. Philanthropy's leaders need to get ahead of this curve while they still can. The Mindful Philanthropist. None of the reforms I've suggested will substantially limit the influence of wealthy philanthropy over public life. Perhaps the best we can hope for is that funders bring greater self-restraint and mindfulness to giving that affects the lives of their fellow citizens. Some of the donors I've spoken with seem to have given little thought to the obvious question of how their influence squares with America's egalitarian values, as if I were broaching an unfamiliar subject. Donors must do more to engage this question and reflect on how they operate. Otherwise, they're just asking for trouble, both in regard to maintaining public trust and achieving impact. A few high-profile philanthropists, like Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan, are already engaged in reflection and are now listening more closely to the communities they're trying to help. The Gates Foundation has also begun to change its style after various missteps in which it failed to bring along key stakeholders. But there's room for much more self-awareness among funders, and especially on such local issues as education and community development, where Americans are rightly sensitive to being bulldozed by wealthy super citizens who parachute in acting like they have all the answers. If we've learned anything in the century of modern philanthropy, it's that few donors actually do have all the answers, and often, the people who can help them the most are those they're trying to help. The good news is that lots of thought has already been given, over many years, to how funders can be better listeners and more responsive to what they learn. Some of that thinking came together in 2014 in a new initiative called the Fund for Shared Insight, which is backed by over half a dozen foundations. This effort seeks to help nonprofits better listen to the people they seek to help, and also to ensure that foundations do a better job of listening to nonprofits. Along these same lines, many foundations now hire the Center for Effective Philanthropy, a Boston-based group, to survey their grantees on what it's like to work with them. The most transparent of those funders make public the findings of these reports. The center has drawn on this work and other research to offer valuable guidance to funders that want to build respectful partnerships with grantees. Other groups, like Grantmakers for Effective Organizations, offer advice along the same lines. Meanwhile, some individual foundations have been breaking new ground in seeking feedback from the people they serve. In Los Angeles, the Weingart Foundation has turned to its grantees, which are mainly community-based groups, for input on its grant-making priorities, and then actually acted on that guidance. The Chicago Community Trust has an initiative called On the Table, holding an annual one-day event to get thousands of Chicagoans talking about the challenges the city faces with the goal of generating actionable funding ideas. Other experiments are also underway around participatory grant making, with the goal of making sure that funders don't get stuck in a bubble. So far, though, it's mainly older, established foundations that are keying into the new push for better listening and stronger feedback loops, as opposed to the mega donors who've more lately arrived on the scene and have often used tactics that feel high-handed. In any case, it remains to be seen whether all the new attention to creating more respectful partnerships between funders and grantees can ultimately do much to offset the power imbalances that seem inherent in philanthropy. Too often, inequities in the charitable sector mirror those of society at large, with the people controlling most of the wealth calling most of the shots. Some of the boldest thinking on how to offset this dynamic can be found in the more radical zones of the philanthrosphere. One group, with an eye to fostering authentic equity between those who give and receive, is Resource Generation, which organizes rich young people to become leaders in social change philanthropy. A key premise of the group's work is that donors need to be ever mindful that their giving doesn't replicate the same unequal power arrangements in society that they're hoping to curb. It's easy for that to happen when donors put themselves in the driver's seat, deciding on their own what solutions will work best or how to enact plans for change. Some 2,200 wealthy heirs have been engaged by Resource Generation since its founding in 1998. Among them, Karen Pittleman, who created a foundation in Boston to help low-income women. Pittleman put up the money, but the ultimate intended beneficiaries of her philanthropy ran the foundation and decided where grants went. She told me, "I wanted to transfer power to the people on the front lines, and I didn't want to define it more than that." Other foundations have been designed in a similar way, like Bread and Roses in Philadelphia, which is fueled by wealthy donors, but where grant-making decisions are made by a committee that includes neighborhood people most directly affected by the grants. The foundation's motto is change, not charity. Or consider the Chorus Foundation, run by Farhad Ibrahimi, the heir to a tech fortune we met earlier in the book. This foundation focuses on climate change, working in communities that are directly affected by the issue, such as coal country in Kentucky and Inuit areas in Alaska, where people's homes are sinking as permafrost melts. While its structure is quite traditional, it bends over backward to really listen to the people on the front lines of the climate crisis. Ibrahimi told me, "We enter into conversations with grantees and potential grantees always as a line of inquiry and not as, we're the very smart foundation that has identified the very smart strategy, and now we're going to put out an RFP to see who wants to implement this strategy for us." That process, he said, means we go spend time with those folks and hear how they're thinking about the problem and what they need to be able to advocate for the solutions that they know are going to work for them. The Chorus Foundation also pays out grants with an eye to empowering nonprofits, giving community-based organizations long-term general support over a period of years so they don't fear that Chorus will turn off the faucet. In contrast, many foundations dole out one-year project grants that can leave grantees feeling like supplicants on a short leash. "We're not going to come once a year to course correct and check and try to tweak and tell them what we would need to see for a grant renewal," said Ibrahimi. "We're saying that we trust them, and we want to give them the capital to do what they need to do. Then we can start really building real relationships with them, and we can talk about all the other ways we can be helpful." Some wealthy donors aren't keen to share too much power with grant recipients, since they often see their own skills and ideas as a prime asset that they bring to solving tough problems. They may also believe that long-time players on an issue have run out of creative steam and aren't able to think outside the box. Newer education reform funders have operated in such a top-down fashion, in part because Walter Annenberg's huge initiative to fix schools in the 1990s, which ceded power to local groups, failed to achieve much change. Viewing insiders as entrenched in a failing system, education donors have seen empowering disruptive outsiders as a key to overturning the status quo. There's a logic to that thinking. On the other hand, the heavy-handedness of K-12 funders in recent years has offered a showcase of big philanthropy's dark side. Their grandiose plans have often failed to anticipate realities on the ground, created intense polarization, and alienated the stakeholders who are essential to successful schools, like teachers. There's plenty of room for a middle ground whereby philanthropists do pursue bold efforts at systemic change, but in ways that are inclusive and don't run roughshod over people with less money and power. Certainly, any donor with a business background should grasp why they'd want to be great listeners and truly engage the end users of philanthropic dollars. Corporations are rightly obsessed with understanding consumer preferences so that they can improve their products and services, which is why we're all bombarded with surveys from hotels, airlines, banks, and so on. Philanthropists should be equally fixated on pressing their ear to the ground in the communities in which they operate, and listening with a humble readiness to learn. Ibrahimi noted, "A mistake that folks in philanthropy can make is, just because you get to sit in a privileged position to hear about more things, doesn't mean that your reaction to those things is any more strategic, or even, frankly, as strategic as folks who are completely focused on one place and the work they do in that place." To ensure communities get heard, some philanthropy reformers have suggested that foundations be mandated by law to have inclusive governing structures. For example, Michael Edwards, a former executive at the Ford Foundation, has argued that no foundation or social enterprise should receive tax exemption unless its board is fully representative of the communities it claims to serve. That proposal sounds hard to operationalize, but there is a strong case that foundation boards should, as a norm, include outsiders, as opposed to just being composed of family members or other insiders. Research on corporate boards has found that having independent directors improves the bottom line. It stands to reason that foundations would also benefit from this approach, and many of the top major foundations do have professional boards. Gordon Moore and George Soros are two examples of living mega-donors who have ceded significant power to outside board members, and in return, have attracted top-tier talent to help guide their philanthropy. Meanwhile, the Gates Foundation has just four board members, Bill and Melinda, William Gates Sr., and Warren Buffett. Perhaps this institution could have avoided some of its mistakes in the past decade if it had had less insular governance. Likewise, greater diversity on foundation boards is also important. Such boards tend to be far whiter, more male, and older than the U.S. population as a whole, which puts philanthropy at a disadvantage in understanding an America undergoing rapid demographic change. The privileged status of this leadership class feeds into a larger problem, which is that philanthropy is not as responsive to poor and marginalized communities as it ought to be. Too many charitable dollars go to elite institutions that mainly cater to the affluent. Too few go to alleviating poverty or fighting injustice, a point that the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy has been making since its founding in 1976. Here again, you'll find proposals for mandating change by law. In his book, Born on Third Base, Chuck Collins, the Oscar Mayer heir who gave away his fortune, argues that Congress should establish two types of charitable entities and give them different tax benefits. Donations to groups that alleviate poverty, reduce inequality, and address urgent social problems would be fully deductible. Donations to other nonprofits would not get the full benefit. Others have made similar proposals. As a practical matter, it seems difficult, if not impossible, to define which nonprofits deliver a public benefit worthy of a full tax break and which do not. One can only imagine the arguments over, say, symphonies. On the other hand, if philanthropy really is as tilted to feathering the nests of the wealthy as critics charge, a question that needs further research, as I've suggested, then some kind of reform along the lines Collins proposes may be needed. Regardless of whether new rules are the answer, philanthropy better start listening more closely to its social justice critics. Quite apart from doing the right thing, if this sector doesn't deliver more to the least fortunate, it may be only a matter of time before the tax breaks that help fuel it will come under fiercer attack in an era of lifeboat fiscal choices. The modest changes I've suggested would produce a philanthropic sector that is more transparent, accountable, and responsive, and also less aggressively political. Still, these changes are unlikely to do much to reduce the influence of private donors over public life in coming decades. As long as activist giving keeps growing while government keeps declining, against a backdrop of vast inequality, power in society will likely keep shifting to the hands of unaccountable donors. This power, as we've seen, will be used for purposes that some of us will cheer and others will fear. My own sense is that the new big philanthropy is likely to be a net positive in its substantive effects on U.S. society. And yet, at the same time, a force increasingly at odds with America's egalitarian values, as we're seeing already. How do we get off this path to benign plutocracy? One answer lies in rebuilding the capacity of citizens to solve problems together through government, as opposed to ceding that work to billionaires. This requires a public sector that is better financed, more nimble and effective, and more responsive to average people. It also means reviving lost ideas about economic democracy. For starters, government needs more resources. To pay for the retirement of baby boomers and still have a public sector that enables us as citizens to tackle big problems will require higher revenue in coming years. That means reversing years of historically low tax rates ushered in during the Reagan years. The wealthy can and should pay more, for instance, through higher taxes on capital gains. But mobilizing greater resources requires that middle and upper middle class households also pay more. One path forward is reducing tax breaks for mortgages, health insurance, and retirement savings that mainly benefit the affluent. Another is finding revenues through new taxes on financial transactions or carbon emissions, as many have suggested. Ideally, our tax system would rely more on taxing bad behavior, like pollution and speculation, and less on taxing good things, like work and investments. Of equal importance is controlling entitlement spending on seniors, and particularly health care costs, which threaten to consume a growing portion of public spending in future decades. This will require limiting the power of market actors in the health care system, as most other advanced countries have done. Reducing national security spending is another imperative. Just maybe, for example, we don't still need a nuclear triad that costs over $30 billion a year to maintain, much less 16 different intelligence agencies. Many of these steps won't be easy or popular, but the alternative is a broke government and citizenry that can't afford to solve problems together, and thus come to rely ever more heavily on private funders to lead the way. Of course, more resources alone will not be enough to revive government as a dynamic agent of change. We also need reforms to make public agencies more flexible, which will require curbing the scope and complexity of regulatory law, updating civil service systems, and limiting the collective bargaining power of some government workers. We can't solve today's problems with yesterday's calcified institutions. In many cases, as we've seen, philanthropy has moved into a void created by ineffective government. If public agencies are going to compete with nonprofits as change agents, attracting the brightest and most idealistic problem solvers, they need to improve how they operate. One other thing. Government certainly should work closely with philanthropy in coming decades in a mix that also includes business. The history of such partnerships goes back to the earliest days of modern philanthropy, and they often have been a key to progress. Just in the past decade, we've seen exciting new initiatives of this kind to tackle an array of challenges, such as creating more opportunities for young men of color, helping veterans, cutting teen pregnancies, and enrolling people in the Affordable Care Act. Looking ahead, public-private partnerships will only grow more important as the squeeze on government funding grows. The tricky thing will be to ensure that, in these relationships, the public sector doesn't find itself on bended knee as a supplicant, which sometimes happens now, with donors occasionally abusing their power by demanding changes in policy. Government needs to embrace philanthropy as a partner, now more than ever, but it can't do so in a way that compromises democratic decision-making. A last point is that big changes are needed to ensure that government actually speaks for most Americans. This means limiting the role of money in politics, even as we expand the voice of ordinary voters. Making it much easier to vote is one way to do the latter, as well as eliminating electoral practices that protect incumbents and ensure that the most ideological candidates prevail at election time. None of this is rocket science, although the political obstacles to such reforms are formidable. A more effective, better-financed public sector that really speaks for Americans would do much to limit the shift of too much power into the hands of private philanthropists as well as corporations. Still, as long as economic inequality remains so entrenched, with the rich getting richer and richer while everyone else treads water, we can also expect high levels of civic inequality. Such inequities always go hand in hand. There are no easy ways to close today's economic chasm. More progressive taxation will make only a limited dent in a problem that's also driven by globalization and technological change, two trends that have greatly strengthened the power of capital vis-a-vis labor. The good news, though, is that some changes in the economy now favor the ability of workers to demand and get a fairer share of the bounty generated by American capitalism. The fastest-growing jobs in the U.S. are service jobs that can't be outsourced or so easily done by machines. Recent successes by the new labor movement, including the fight for a $15 minimum wage, show the limits of capital's playbook of shipping jobs to Mexico or China. A new era of economic democracy hasn't dawned yet, but we're getting glimpses of it. And if our government institutions were not dominated by money and special interests, always tilting the rules toward capital, we'd see ordinary workers get a bigger share of the pie. Along with higher taxes on the rich, this shift would limit the size of the fortunes at the top of our society, along with the philanthropic power that can come with such wealth. Given the trajectory of American life over recent decades, it's easy to feel fatalistic about a future ever more dominated by wealthy people, as well as their money and ideas. But it doesn't have to be that way. There's lots of room for a major course correction. In the alternative future I've just sketched out, philanthropy, one of America's greatest inventions, would remain a powerful force for solving problems and improving society. But it wouldn't come to trump this nation's more important invention, democracy. This is Ryan Gazelle. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Givers, Wealth, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age by David Callahan. This program was directed by Kathy Thornburn. Executive producer, Janet Stark. Text copyright 2017 by David Callahan. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.